This is Jim Colby from Vox Urbana, and you are listening to 90.7 FM WGXC Acra.
Hey, everybody. We're the Game Hoarders. We're on every Thursday from 3:30 to 4.
We're invading your airwaves. Come on, it would be fun.
I'm not always there, but when I am, you get to hear my epic voice.
On WGXC 90.7 FM.
Where you listen to all the best music, and you can definitely hear us invading.
We're better.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by the First Presbyterian Church of Hudson, a faith community open to all. Whether you are single, married, divorced, gay, wealthy, poor, or no habla inglés, if you are just browsing, just woke up, or just got out of jail, it doesn't matter if you work on Wall Street or if you sleep on Wall Street, you belong. We love soccer moms, crying babies, vegans, hipsters, seekers and doubters, tourists and locals. All are welcome. Services held Sunday mornings at 10:45 a.m. You can find us on the web at firstpreshudson.org.
That was Tommy Dorsey with I'm Getting Sentimental Over You. And this is Richard Roth with The Passage on WGXC. My guest this month is Tony Thompson, an artist who has been around Hudson since the 1980s or so. I am here with Tony Thompson in his studio in Hudson. Tony, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Talk about your artist career and teaching career.
Well, I don't know if there would be two careers there if the artist career didn't have to be supported. In other words, the teaching career supports the artist career. And almost always I've been a part-time teacher. I had maybe a total of 7 out of 50 years or whatever that I had a full-time job. And often that some of that was at an enlightened institution where they believe that you should continue with your creative work as well as your teaching. And so they limited the full-time teaching position to give you enough time to spend doing your work.
Where did you grow up?
I was born in Scarsdale, New York, not far from Manhattan. My father always worked, commuted into the city. When I was a little older, we moved farther from the city to Connecticut. And so I grew up from, say, fifth grade on in Connecticut. And I went to college at Dartmouth. I started there. And after 2 years, I transferred to RISD. I like to say that at Dartmouth, at that time, there was neither any art or any women, and I had to have one or the other at least. So,
Were you studying art at Dartmouth?
Well, you couldn't. That was the problem. I mean, I took two extracurricular courses. Paul Sample, who was a famous regional New England painter, used to teach a painting class one afternoon a week. That was not for credit. You just went and did that class because you liked it. And he also taught a life drawing class one evening a week. But there again, that was an extracurricular activity, so it didn't have a bearing.
So you'd always been interested in art?
Ever since drawing dinosaurs in kindergarten. So I had, my thought was in high school that I would go to a liberal arts college and then go to art school afterwards. But when I got there, I was impatient. So instead of waiting for the 4 years, I transferred at the end of my sophomore year and went to RISD.
And at RISD, what did you do?
Well, because I had all my liberal arts courses under my belt, I had a lot of freedom. And so when I was first there, I majored in painting, sculpture, and illustration, the three. After a while, I changed it to painting. And I was also interested in printmaking. And that was like, back when I arrived there, that was like being in paradise. I was only studying stuff that I was really interested in. I wasn't doing economics or whatever. And the social life was like natural. It wasn't like having a date. I mean, at Dartmouth, if you wanted to see a woman, you had to plan ahead for weeks and take a bus ride or whatever it was. So as an art student in art school, you're working in the evening in the print shop and your social life is the same thing. Instead of going to a movie, having a date to go to the movie, you go work in the print shop and everybody's there working. So it was a very natural thing. So So the plan was always that being an artist is impractical and hard to make a living and so forth. And so the plan was always to try to get a teaching job. So when I finished my degree at RISD, I went to graduate school at Cornell and got an MA degree, teaching degree from Cornell. It was a Master of Fine Art, but if you wanted to be a college teacher, pretty much needed an MA. Now there are even PhDs of fine arts, but at that time, that was, I think Ohio State had a PhD in art, but the terminal degree, as they say, was a teacher. So what I did was apply to every... I didn't want to go to New York, which was probably a mistake, but I had grown up in New York and around New York, and my mother at that time lived in New York. And so I applied to jobs between Boston and Washington, D.C. So I applied to everything that was opening there. And I got a part-time job at a small school in Boston called Pine Manor College. And for the next 11 years, I spent every Tuesday and Thursday at Pine Manor College. And it was pretty interesting. Boston was a vibrant, you know, had a lot of cultural and art stuff going on. There was galleries and so forth. And so I got involved in the Boston art scene and met a lot of artists and showed in some galleries there. And at a certain point realized that I had to go to New York just because Boston had a funny, at least to me, other people may feel differently, but to me, there was a kind of a ceiling on culture in Boston, meaning that it was a tremendous college town. There were all kinds, you know, Boston College, BU, Harvard, et cetera, et cetera. And a theater, a college theater, and all kinds of art activities that were based on colleges. But anybody who was a serious collector went to New York to buy their stuff, even though there were lots of good exhibitions at the schools. It was just that feeling that, well, what happened basically was I missed Einstein on the beach. That was a big thing. And not only did I miss Einstein on the beach once, miss meaning it took place and I didn't know about it. Okay. Not only did that happen once, it happened twice, as they did a sometime later, I don't know but how much time elapsed from the first performance to mounting it again. But I missed it the second time, and so I decided I had to move to New York. And I didn't have a job. I didn't have any job in New York. Couldn't get a job in New York. But I made arrangements, since I was only teaching Tuesday and Thursday. I just went to New York, and I commuted back up to Boston to teach those two days a week. And then that got to be a drag, and so I quit. I thought, I'll sell pencils on the sidewalk. A saving thing happened. A painter that I knew had gotten a offer to teach a visiting artist gig at Morehead State in Minnesota. It's right across the river from Fargo. So that was a six weeks to go there and teach. And they were very enlightened as far as what an artist needs, and they gave me a studio. And my duties were limited, but I had to let people see what I was doing in my studio. And I did have to do an exhibition, and all of these things I did in consultation with the students. And it was a really good experience. I found that the students there were really open, and they were. Boston had a little bit of snootiness and an edge of knowing everything or being sophisticated and stuff. And their kids at Morehead State, they didn't have any pretensions to that. But they were open to anything you could tell them. So that was a good thing. And I did a show there, and at the time I was making work that consisted of building up brushstrokes. It's a funny thing to be doing an interview about visual art and not be able to see any of it. But anyway, I did a piece called 40 Days in Fargo, which was a highlight of my trip. Had a nice exhibition, and it was a good experience. And in the meantime, I stored up a bunch of cash in order to survive until I got a part-time teaching job at Parsons. And so I don't know how many years I had a part-time job at Parsons, I think 11 or 12 years, something like that. A couple of classes, basically.
You're teaching drawing and painting and that sort of thing?
I did a little of everything. I started teaching painting, and then I got fired from teaching painting. The powers that be said that the students said I wasn't teaching them anything. And to some extent, they were right, because I didn't teach them how to do things. I taught them to work and to look and so forth. But anyway, I got fired from there, so I managed to go to the foundation year, which was a separate department, and then I taught drawing or whatever at that. And then I was a liberal arts advisor for a while, which means I talked to all the Parsons students about the problems they were having with their liberal arts requirements. You know, they had to take English, they had to take this, that, and the other thing. So I was sort of a troubleshooter for that. And it's easy. I seem to be talking more about my teaching jobs than about my artwork, but it's easy because they're in the lump and there's something that you're doing. So, whereas,
so meanwhile, you were making art all this time.
Meanwhile, I was making art and I was making connections. You know, I was meeting. There were a group of painters who I played squash with. There was a basement. Downtown basement, No Frills Squash Club. A painter named Jim Sullivan was in my class at RISD, and then we lost track of each other, but we met up again in New York, and he was playing with Murray Reich and different. There were a lot of artists that played squash in this basement. Squash Club. And as a result, you know, you meet other people and you try to have critics come over to your do studio visits and stuff. You're networking, in other words. So it's hard to organize in my mind how exactly I networked. But I had a show at Artist Space, for instance, which was just still going, I think, sort of a non-profit place. And people saw my work. I had a show at PS1, and got some write-ups and stuff. And I even did a show at Rutgers where the New York Times even did a show at Rutgers where the New York Times referred to my work as a sorry little blob of acrylic paint. It's one of those things that got on the wall.
Oh, yes.
For those of you who can't see, these were sort of brush strokes done over and over again until they built up to a thickness. And they were done on.
Oh, so the thickness is all paint.
It's all paint, yeah. Those are paintings that are nothing but paint. Then they were done flat and then peeled up off of the polyethylene or whatever it was. And so I made the New York Times, but it wasn't too flattering. But people say it doesn't make any difference as long as I spell your name right. So I did that. And Julian Preto.
Yeah, I knew Julian. I knew him personally, yeah.
Okay, well, Julian Preto saw my work probably at PS1, I'm not sure where. At that time, he had a little space on Spring Street. But more importantly, he recommended me to Hal Brahm, who had a gallery farther downtown. And so I had a couple of shows at Hal Brahm. I should say that Margaret and I in Boston, she was a student at Pine Manor College.
Oh.
I was her instructor. And this was one of those flash-in-the-pan student-teacher relationships, which is still going on 40-something years later.
And so then you decided to kind of escape the city.
Yeah. Yeah, well, a number of things happened. One was that the art scene became less interesting to me. It was a time when figuration started to come back into the picture, which had been pretty much an abstract, formless kind of work. And that was the work that I grew up with, and that was what my work was. And so I became less interested in the work that I saw in the galleries, which made me think it was less necessary for me to be there in New York to see what was going on, because I wasn't too interested in what was going on. That sounds closed-minded and stuff, but the point is either you see stuff which is exciting to you and makes you think about movement in your own work and so forth, or you see stuff and it just seems irrelevant. So, this is a whole other category. I was very interested in cognitive psychology. I was interested in why people make painting, why people like painting, that sort of thing. And so I got a deal when I was at Parsons that I could take graduate courses at the New School. I could take the same number of credits as I was teaching. So it took me 4 years and something to do a 2-year degree, but I went to the New School and got a degree in cognitive psychology. So that was another thing that was going on. That started back at Pine Manor College again, because I had a lot of students who were, it was at that time, and I guess it still is, just a women's college. And it was a 2-year college, and parents sent their daughters there, wealthy parents, if their daughters were having trouble academically. That was one reason. The other reason was that they might need a Harvard student, you know, and marry well, so to speak. But I found that I had some very interesting students who I really enjoyed talking to and discussing things with. And then I would get a call from the dean saying that Joni was flunking this and flunking that and everything else. And how is she doing in printmaking? Or how is she doing in painting stuff? And that was sort of became an amazing pattern, because these were often students that I felt were the most interesting, that I enjoyed talking with the most, and that were doing good work in printmaking or painting, whatever it was. And I wonder why that was, and that got me interested in dyslexia and other kinds of neurological and cognitive problems. And so that started the whole cognitive thing, and which culminated in getting this degree. Also, I should mention that I had a daughter in the middle of a class in motivation. I had a daughter. I had to drop out of the class for that semester, and then return to finishing the degree when we got a little bit more used to having Louisa. And Louisa, interestingly enough, was very interested in neuropsychology and cognitive psychology, and she's now a doctor Louisa, and she is working in neuropsychology. So she's at Brown University and working in the hospital in Providence and doing research and clinical stuff. And I must say that I also looked around and saw a lot of people that were older than me and that were artists and that were not, overwhelmingly successful, and the struggles that they were having just keeping alive in the city. It got more expensive. We had to keep running out more and more of our loft space to other people in order to continue to be part-time workers and so forth. So we moved up here. We rented a place for 3 years to see if it was possible to live outside of Manhattan. And it turned out it was pretty interesting. So then for the first couple years, I was commuting into New York. We kept a space in the city, and I would go and stay over and eat Chinese food and then come back to Hudson. Then Columbia Green Community College had just finished building a new art building, and they needed somebody to set up an art department. So I went in and had an interview and got the job of organizing and setting up an art department and an exhibition program. And I did that for 5 years. And in the New York State system, after 5 years, you either have to be given tenure or you have to quit or whatever. You're fired or you're given tenure. So after 5 years, I was fired. And my good friend Steve Corot, who was working in the art department there at the time, took my job. That was a great shift in things. But it worked out pretty well. I just got an email from Steve about about some research in consciousness. But anyway, after that, I had made a strange regression into landscape painting. Margaret does furniture restoration, restores finished stuff, as she probably said. And she had a piece of furniture that had a landscape painted on it, and it was too far gone to be restored. And so she needed to have a landscape painted on in place of the one that was there. And so I did that. And I thought, hey, this is fun. I had always done landscapes when I started as an art student. It's my first love. I painted landscape for a long time. And So I did that, and I enjoyed it. And the I did a couple of other things like that. And I had a dealer named Mary Udell, who lives in Hudson or Tacana now. And she said, why don't you paint some landscapes? So I did, and then I had the tremendous novel experience of actually selling work and actually being able to, albeit minimally, make a living by making pictures. So I had at that time, for quite a while, and to some extent I still do have, a kind of schizophrenic studio where I have my abstract painting, which continues. I was interested in seeing if it was at all possible to combine those two things. Can you have a real illusionistic, figurative, representational painting and a formalist, physical presence, abstract work? Can you put them together? Can you make one work that has those things? And so I tried a bunch of different ways of doing that. That was an interesting project for quite a while.
You said that that Margaret was doing a restoration and there was a need for a landscape painting on a chair. Was that it?
I don't think it was a chair. I think it was like a dresser.
Oh, yes.
It had bigger, like two good-sized panels on the side. Something like that.
Uh-huh. And so they needed paintings of some...
Yeah, there were paintings there, and normally whenever... The state of the piece of furniture, Margaret tries to save what's there.
Right.
It's restoration, you just paint it to look like it's brand new. Whereas if it's conservation, you try to save it. But anyway, I wound up painting a landscape. You know, as I said before, as a student, painted landscape most of my undergraduate years and into graduate study. I was pretty much painting landscapes. One of the things I missed about abstraction is that with the painting from the landscape, you come across color combinations, you know, colors next to each other or whatever, that you don't. I mean, when you're doing it yourself with abstraction, you're in charge and you put this color next to it or you change the color. But with landscape painting, you're coming up against the color of some grass next to a stone or whatever, that you hadn't thought of those colors before. So I continue to be very fond of landscape painting, even though I was shifted most of my output to abstraction. Was in the city, I would go and see landscape exhibitions. And so it wasn't, painting these landscapes wasn't entirely new to me. I mean, on the furniture, it's just that I hadn't done it in a while. And so then I mentioned that the suggestion was made, why don't you just paint some landscapes without the furniture? So I did. I enjoyed them. Not surprising, they're much more accessible than my abstract work. So I continue to do that.
The ones in your studio here are mostly painted from life?
Mostly from photographs. When I was younger, I painted outside. You know, I had a tripod with I hung a cinder block from so that the wind wouldn't blow the canvas away. And there was the dust and the bugs and the dirt. So when I started in again to spend significant time with the landscape, I mostly worked from photographs.
Photographs of your own?
Photographs of my own, mostly. That had the advantage of, you know, overcoming that problem with the landscape is that at a certain point you have to decide what the light is, and then from then on to the rest of the painting, you're remembering the light that was at the time that you decided this is when the when the landscape's going to be. You know, 12 o'clock and 2 o'clock and 4 o'clock are all very different if the sun is out. So I found with the photographs, I could use a number of photographs, and I could sort of freeze the image. And I think that it was very important to me to have done painting from nature, to be painting directly from nature, because of the style that develops. I mean, given that the landscape is changing, you really paint pretty fast. At least I painted sort of in a frenzy to get the thing down on the canvas before it changed too much, whatever. So what I tried to do when I'm working from photographs was to maintain that kind of action or excitement or frenzy, even though I was painting in the studio with a photograph that wasn't going to change, and I could get my small brushes and I could paint everything in tiny detail and take hours. I didn't enjoy that. I enjoyed the painting the way I would if I was out in the field. So that's...
Now, when you paint these ones where you you paint a scene and then you might say flip the canvas around, mm-hmm. and you play it on the other side.
That whole thing started, I mentioned before, the underlying idea that I wanted to see if I could bring abstraction and figuration together without damaging either one. And that was actually, I think, the first of those paintings. And that came from having a card from, or two cards, from the museum in Utica. They had, that's a George Innes painting. And I had two cards, for some reason I had two, and they're lying on the table. One turned this way and the other turned that way. And I saw that as a composition. And I saw it first, you know, as an abstraction, because I'm looking, I'm not thinking about the landscape, but I'm seeing these shapes moving in a certain way. And so, you know, Eureka. So I did that one. Happened to be done from another artist's work based on another artist's painting. And I did a show at Carey's once that was all painted that way. They were all, this one. This one was, there were however many pieces were in the show, they were all based on other artists' work taken in.
And for the most part, you seem to paint the local area.
Yeah. I've spent a lot of time in Nantucket, and I've done a lot of landscape paintings in Nantucket. It's the antithesis of here, because it's so flat.
It's flat.
It's super flat in a whole different kind of space with a big sky and so forth. That painting that's in there hanging on the wall is sort of quintessential beach Nantucket painting. And then the mountains and stuff. Here they're more vertical. But pretty much everything, most of it's been where I've experienced the landscape and I've taken the pictures. So that's where I've been. And there are probably a few from Europe. Margaret got tired of me once and sent me to Europe. I went on a sort of a painting trip. Actually, I went on a photographing for painting trip. So I have a bunch of paintings that came from that trip. And then other vacation pictures.
Which reminds me of Sicily. Was that a fun time?
Yeah. I didn't do much landscape photography. I pretty much looked at other art, especially mosaics. Mosaics were really amazing to me. I never paid.
And those date from what time?
Well, different times. There are stuff in Palermo is, I don't know what the dates are, but they're from like the Norman, mostly from the Norman period. And the Normans were in charge. And then there's Monterreale outside of Palermo, which is a little bit later. And then there are the Roman frescoes out of the country. It's an old villa, and the building has deteriorated. But they built a sort of catwalk all along the wall, you know, above the walls, a catwalk, so you can walk along as though you were up at the level of the ceiling, and you can look down at the images in the floor. And that was amazing. And it occurred to me that two things. One, the Romans never saw those the way a tourist today can see them. You know, you couldn't stand about 3 or 4 feet above the ceiling and look down and see the total image of the decoration on the floor. In fact, not only that, but there would be furniture on the floor and there would be people working in there. So to see the whole composition was, we got it better than the Romans did. And that interested me a lot. Then it also interested me that some rooms are designated as having probably been work rooms where the cooks were cooking or whatever like that, or utility rooms if you want. Some were designated for dining rooms and bedrooms and stuff. But it was interesting that the utility rooms were so completely decorated. They didn't perhaps use as many colors as some of the other ones, but you have a whole floor of geometric patterns. And so why do that? In a utility room, why spend all that money and time? I mean, I guess labor was cheap, but still, to go to all that trouble to decorate them fully. And it falls into my theory of art, which I won't burden you with. I'll give you a little piece of paper to tell you what it is. But it has to do with art being exercise, music exercise in hearing, painting being exercise in vision. That by helping music, that musicians are better at separating noise from signal and working in foreign language, getting pronunciation in foreign languages and other verbal skills comes from that. So anyway, that's, people are just crazy decorators and it keeps their eyes busy all the time. And one thing that struck me as an abstract, in Montreal, it's not French, it's Montreale. It's not Montreal, which is just outside of Palermo. And in the cathedral in Palermo, the presence of the Catholic Church is overwhelming. In the imagery aspects of the mosaics, it's all saints and episodes and people, and they're all crying, very worried. It's a real downer as far as the image goes. And then interspersed through all that, you have this ebullient decoration, beautiful curlicues and dots and patterns and stuff like that. And I got the feeling that we were, that was our consolation. If we had to put up with all this pain and suffering, at least we got these gorgeous decorations to make us feel positive, because the imagery is a real downer most of the time. That was the most interesting aspect of Sicily to me, was that. And also the language was hard to understand.
And the food was good?
Yeah, food was good. And the landscape was, parts of the landscape were just beautiful. Just, I don't know, I guess I was overwhelmed with the whole thing. I wasn't thinking of this as a working trip, but I did get a lot of landscape photographs. And who knows what will come of them. But lots of, it was in April, you know, at the end of April, the flowers were, there were poppies and all kinds of flowers. I don't know what they were. It was a good time of year. And mostly there weren't a lot of,
So you continue to do landscapes and abstract work side by side?
Yeah. I've been doing a little bit more. It tends to not be evenly balanced. I tend to get off into the abstraction one time and then off into the figurations. Lately I've been doing more drawings. I don't know if it's because it just seems like you don't have to be quite as ambitious to make a drawing compared to a big.
Now, these pieces on the wall, you're actually collages, aren't they?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, the bigger work was always collage in the sense that it was never in a frame and hung on the wall. It was always applied directly to the wall. Whether it's those paint pieces from the 70s or whatever, they're not on a not in a format. For a long time, I was suspicious of the format. I mean, it's been, you know, the rectangle has been used for so many different things, different kinds of illusion. So, to me, the piece was more real if it was just stuck on the wall, you know, borders or frames of glass. So, yeah, these are collages. And of course, the collage on paper would be, if they were shown, they'd be on a, you know, under glass. But the other pieces are just stuff that's stuck in the wall.
Have you used these carpets for a long time?
Yeah, yeah. The last show I had at Carrie's was the carpet. I'm not sure if that was the reason it was the last show or not. But they were big, much bigger. They came because I wanted a piece of patterning. I wanted to use a piece of patterning. I started out using cotton prints, you know, cutting little pieces of squares or rectangles out of cloth, out of whatever you call it. And Joanne Fabrics was my favorite art supply store. And now it's Ocean State Big Lots or whatever they are, John. Because they carry these inexpensive fake Oriental rugs. But anyway, it started because I was doing drawings and I wanted to have it to contrast some simple forms with ones that were very intricate and articulate with patterning and shape and stuff like that. But I didn't want to be bothered making those intricate patterns and shapes myself, so I started looking around to appropriate somebody else's patterns and shapes, and that came to the fabric and then to the rugs. The rugs are so physical, that's another advantage. They're not just a square pattern, they're also half an inch or more thick, and they're textured and stuff like that. So they're really a thing. And so that's the value of the rugs from here. Way to get pattern into a way to have a physical pattern thing in the work. Who knows what? Well, as I said, I've been working more on the little ones, which use drawing as well as paint and collage, cut paper. And I haven't been painting as I seem to. My pace of painting seems to have slowed down. Not too worried about having a big output at this point. And I pretty much just enjoy making the things.
Do you and Margaret sort of shut yourselves off in your studios during the day?
Yes, we do. But then we also do studio visits.
Oh, yes. Uh-huh.
You know, I'll know when Margot wants me to come in and look at something that she's done. She'll say something out that I'll hear out there, so then I'll know I ought to go in. And vice versa, when there's something that I've done. I once had a teacher at Disney. His name was Herbert Pauli Cummings. I don't know if he was a particularly famous teacher, but he said sometimes you're working away and you get something and you want to open the door and invite a dog in to look and see what you've been doing. So I don't mean that we're like dogs to each other, but there's sometimes you just like to bounce it off. It's inevitable that the other person won't say anything of value to you, but it's just, you know, sometimes it's something worth considering. And it just, there's that urge to do that for some reason, at least there has been for me. And that's, I think that's some of the thing about showing your work too. I mean, to me, the essence of doing the work is to amaze myself, just to do something and say, wow, look at that, or where did that come from, or isn't that something like that. But then you also want to see if you can amaze somebody else, what will they do, and if you can. There's an expression, I'm not sure exactly what it is, at pâté la bourgeoisie, which basically means to shake up the bourgeoisie, just disturb the middle class, and some of the exhibiting is for that purpose, as has been to me. Not that I start out off trying to do that, except that something will suggest to me that I should do this, and this, this, and this, and then I wind up with something that seems to me striking, and I want to see if anybody else will go for it, or whether it'll be totally turned off. That. But I don't know. I think at this point I'll be 80 in August, so I'm getting pretty old. I'm slowing down mentally as well as physically. It's easier to see the physical problems that slow you down. I'm not running the 50-yard dash anymore, but. That's happening, and I've done a lot of painting and exhibitions and stuff, and I've gotten to the point with my theory of art where I think it's kind of finished, and the new research that comes in seems to be supporting. Seems to be supporting what I'm thinking about. So I sort of relax, just enjoy making things, and enjoy thinking about about why people make art. And so that's where we stand now.
Well, that seems like a pretty good note to finish on, actually. Is there anything more you'd like to say?
Oh, one thing. I just made a little note because it's been thinking about it. I've been thinking of, places to show the work and stuff. And the Albany Mohawk Regional Show, do you know about that? Every year they have it. It's 1 year it's in the SUNY College at Albany, SUNY Albany Gallery, and it's in the Hyde Collection. And I think there's a third venue, maybe the Museum of Culture and Art or whatever it's called, Albany. And so I was checking that out just to see, I think the possibility of sending something to a pâté de bourgeoisie out. And then I found out that there's an entry fee that you have to pay, $25 or whatever, I think it's $25, to show your work. And along long time ago in Albany, we had a thing called the Boston Visual Artists Union, which was to to be a union in the sense of a union for artists to see that artists got a fair shake and stuff like that. And we had a long campaign against entry fees, which is basically the artist paying to show their work. And he said, would you make a musician pay you to come in and play music for you or whatever like that? And in the case of a college, which is our places that show a lot of work, if SUNY Albany is a good school, they're using that exhibition. They have an exhibition, of how many, 50 contemporary artworks, and if they're a good school, the English department is coming in and writing about it and finding ways of using that exhibition program. So you have the artist furnishing the university with a teaching aid and having to pay to do that. So I'm sort of trying to decide whether to break 50 years of abstention from entry fees or whether to say, well, what the hell, it'll be fun to show the work. So I'm studying Italian now that I came home, which is fun, but I don't. It's like a totally self-sustained exercise since I don't foresee going to Italy again. But it's fun learning how to say the cows are drinking.
That was Tony Thompson, and this is Richard Roth with The Passage on WGXC. My next guests include Dan Weldon, the master printmaker, and the cellist Yehuda Hanani. As always, we are in financial straits here at the station, so anytime you can offer a little help, it will be greatly appreciated. Go to WGXC.org and you'll find a place to make donations. Thank you very much.
They sing down the highway and travel.